Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Greetings. Welcome across the country. It's Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC. 877-973-7425. Well, you know what's racist? The new racism? Student loans. Student loans are racist. I know you didn't know yesterday. It's hard to keep up with the wokes. I mean, one day something is orthodoxy, the next day it's heresy. Yesterday it's just student loans. Student loans were bad. Let's get rid of them. Today, you're racist if you don't want to get rid of the student loans. You're racist. It's bad. Racism. One of the members, what is it, Elena Presley, who also wants to defund the police, is out there saying that if you don't get rid of, you're not anti-racist if you're not anti-student loan. You know, one day they're going to boot me off of terrestrial radio and I'm just going to be on satellite, and that's where I can use the words that are roaming around my head right now with letters that start with like F. The idea that it's racist if you think people ought to pay their debt obligations is one of the craziest things. Now, of course, the media is going all in on this stuff now. The Democrats want to fire the head of the Congressional Budget Office because the head of the Congressional Budget Office says that if you raise the minimum wage, it'll impact the deficit negatively. And also that if you try to buy out or bail out student loans, you're going to drive up the debt in the country. Well, the media is going all in on this stuff. The Washington Post now has this, the faces of student debt. Nearly 45 million people hold $1.7 trillion in education loans. Here are some of their stories. There are parents who have traded in their financial security for their children's dreams. Husbands who have dropped out of college to care for family. Professionals who bid for parity at work has pushed retirement further out of reach. And young graduates who forego health insurance to pay down their loans. These are some of the stories of the nearly 45 million people who hold $1.7 trillion in education loans in the United States. For some, repayment of the debt is an inconvenience. For others, it's a burden. Public misconceptions about who has student loans and why simplifies what is a nuanced and complex discussion over debt relief. Among the fastest growing categories of student loan borrowers over the past two decades are black students and people aged 50 and over, according to the latest Federal Reserve data. Between 2010 and 2015, the number of outstanding loans by borrowers 50 and older grew by 80%, more than 32 percentage points higher than the growth of borrowers below 50 years old, according to Federal Reserve data. The trend has continued in recent years, according to the Department of Education. In 2019, the Federal Reserve found that borrowing rates were higher in areas with a majority of black residents. The agency noted the income disparities are likely driven by lower-income students who are more likely to need loans to pay for school. And the merits of student debt cancellation are debated, we talk to borrowers in these categories to show how debt affects people at various stages of their life. Dozens share their stories, but we narrowed the group down to a few who represent significant trends. Oh, you can bet they're the heartstring-pulling stories. Do you know what? I have student loans. In fact, I have my latest bill right here. I had to refinance my student loan. My monthly payment is $377.34. I refinanced it, actually. It originally had been a payment of about $475, and I have 13 more years to pay on it, and I've been out of law school since the year 2000. I used to have more. When my wife and I first got married, 20 years ago, can you all believe that? She's put up with me that long. Got married right out of law school, 25 years old. And our student loan payments were more than our combined salaries. You know what we did? We had to go into forbearance and stop paying the loans, and the interest compounded until we made more income and we could start paying. We had to do those things. I sometimes get very frustrated because the bulk of my student loans are from law school. I did not get a scholarship to go to law school. I did very well in law school, but the law school I was going to fairly well knew it was the only one that I wanted to go to. They didn't have to offer me anything, and I was still going to go, and I pretty much floated it 100% on student loans. And I'll be paying them off, and I haven't practiced law since 2006, really. But I got a great education. I mean, the thing about law school people don't understand is that law school doesn't actually teach you the law. It retrains you how to think in a different way and to write in different ways, to argue in different ways, and to research in different ways. You don't learn those skills in college. The bulk of your law school training, your first year in particular, is how do you research and how do you read a legal case and pick out the arguments and then be able to reform in the same phrasing, the same way, the same style, the same pattern of arguments. How do you read a legal case and break out the rule of law, particularly in common law? It requires a more analytical thing. Between law school and seminary, my desire to read a book is basically zero between law school and seminary. And, you know, I'm one of those people who I don't like to highlight in books. I know most people are like, oh, yeah, mark it up. I hate to deface a book. I do. It's from my upbringing, from my old librarian when I was growing up. I hate to write in a book. I got sticky notes and books, and then they fall out and messes me up. But nonetheless, I got student loans. I don't spend my time bellyaching about it. It's not racist. I undertook the obligation to get my education. I will never forget. I wish I could find this article back during the Obamacare fight. There was a guy, the Washington Post, I'm almost 90% sure it was the Washington Post interviewed this guy, demanding Obamacare because he couldn't afford health insurance because he got a crappy job. And he was burdened by student loans. Do you know what the guy's degree was in? If you've listened to this program for a long time, you know what I'm about to tell you. This guy, I kid you not, he had a degree, a master's degree, a master's degree in puppetry arts. I do not know why one must get a master's degree in shoving your hand up the rectum of an inanimate object, but apparently he needed a master's degree to show how to shove your hand up the backside of a Muppet. He should work as a Walmart lobbyist and use Asa Hutchinson in Arkansas as a Muppet. Maybe he's got to pull the strings or something. I have no idea. But the guy needed universal health care for all of us because he got a freaking master's degree in puppetry arts and couldn't pay off his student loans. I'm sure his mother and father laughed him out of the house when he asked them to mortgage their house to pay for his master's in puppetry arts. Don't call me and try to defend a master's in puppetry arts. But... And now the left wants you to know you're racist because of the high proportion of black students who get student loans. We're all racist if we don't want to bail out the student loans, if we don't want to get rid of them. You know the real problem here. The left in this country is fixated on getting rid of student loans. It's racist now, according to at least one member of Congress. You're not anti-racist unless you're anti-student loan. We got to bail them out. the Biden administration wants to do massive debt forgiveness. Never mind people like me who've actually busted my butt to pay back my loans. Most of them are repaid. I've got one left. I'll get nothing for the money I paid for. You had Elizabeth Warren, remember, during the campaign, was confronted by a man whose child and himself had done everything right, had worked, gotten a good job, paid off their loans. Why was their tax dollars now going to go to bail out someone who couldn't do the right thing and couldn't get a job? And you know what? No one wants to talk about. Nobody wants to have this discussion. College tuition costs. Maybe it's the college tuition costs that are the real racism. I mean, young black people now from low incomes getting into colleges and colleges bleeding them for all they're worth. Maybe they should talk about that racism. You've got Harvard has a multi-billion dollar endowment. David Hogg, the gun right, it's a gun control activist from Florida who, by the way, dude wanted to start his own MyPillow company and has bailed out. His grades are suffering. He's had to walk away after wanting a unionized American-made pillow company. Like, my bad, guys. I'm sorry. My grades are slipping. Whatever. Colleges, there's no accountability in the cost of college. There's no accountability right now for the massive spike in tuition. Tuition in college campuses around this country has gone up way more than inflation. And by the way, a lot of it is not like they're paying their professors anymore. They're adding on all sorts of programs and building campaigns and the like. Some of them have massive endowments. At some point, there's got to be a massive collapse in the number of colleges in this country. There are, frankly, more colleges than there are demand for colleges. And those colleges jack up their costs and their tuition, knowing that you can go get, in many cases, a subsidized student loan covered by the federal government that you do not have to pay a penny on the entire time you're there, so you have no concept of the cost of it or what you're going to be making when you get out on the other side, and then you're stuck with this massive bill. And the college then comes to you and wants money from you to perpetuate their endowment or whatnot. Colleges and universities in this country need to have a reckoning. Instead of having to talk about student loans, we need to have to talk about college salaries. You know, look at Rick Perry. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, former governor of Texas, campaigned on a $10,000 a year college degree. And the university system in Texas went bat poop crazy, refused as best they could, and ultimately I think he was able to see it through and people could get a degree. And for a while there, you even had them fighting, saying, well, we're just going to give you an associate degree. We're not going to give you a real degree. Real degree costs you money. But people were able to finally get a real bachelor's of arts from colleges in Texas for $10,000. There's no reason that a basic college degree, a college education, teaching you to think more critically, read deeper into books and learn should cost you $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 like it does at many private schools. And a lot of now institutions of higher learning that are public are outrageous as well. If we're not going to have a discussion about college tuition inflation, we're not having a real discussion, because the student loan market has caused college tuition to skyrocket. In fact, the solution is not to pay off or forgive or bail out student loans. The solution is to ban student loans. Get rid of the student loan program, and you will see a remarkable collapse in college tuition in this country. Get rid of the student loan industry itself, and colleges and universities will be forced to scale back to reality. Now, they will bellyache, they will moan, they will complain. Some of them will go out of business. Good riddance. The fewer academic incubators for ignorance, the better. But we don't want to have that conversation. The Biden administration doesn't want to have it. The left doesn't want to have it. Why? Because academics are their constituent base. Essentially, the student loan industry props up an entirely large and almost universally consolidated Democratic base of votes. You keep the student loan industry going, and then you bail out the students. Well, you keep the money flowing to the academic institutions that provide you a reliable pool of elite white voters for the Democratic Party. So they don't want to touch. They don't want to touch the actually getting rid of student loans. They don't want to deal with college inflation. They don't want to deal with outrageous tuition. Instead, they'd have the American taxpayers bail out the people who got loans for degrees in puppetry arts and can't pay them back. Why not foster responsibility instead of fostering government bailout for people who can't pay back? Some of them are real sob stories. I get it. But you know what? There are risks in life. The government shouldn't bail you out from those risks. Don't you want to grill out this coming weekend? Where I am, the weather's going to be gorgeous. Actually, now that I look at it, no, maybe not on Saturday. But nonetheless, it should be gorgeous wherever you are at some point. And how would you like to get almost 4 pounds of free burgers? Not just any old ground chuck burger from your local grocery store. I'm talking good quality meat. You can do that at Omaha Steaks. What you do is you go to omahasteaks.com and you put Georgia in the search bar. The name of the state, Georgia, put it in the search bar. And you will see the Let's Go Grill package. You're going to get steak. You're going to get chicken. You're going to get pork chops. You're going to get sausage. You're going to get 4 pounds of burgers free, just under 4 pounds. 12 5-ounce burgers, and they're great. Y'all, I have been grilling these Omaha Steak burgers. I actually order them. I'm a customer. I don't just endorse them. This is the greatest, coolest thing is I've been a customer of Omaha Steaks for years. And now I get to tell you about them and my love of them. I got a brisket from them. I didn't even know for the longest time I could get a brisket. I thought you just got like steaks and pork chops and burgers. You can get a brisket. You can get seafood. I got a brisket, and I spoke to brisket. Because I'm actually from Louisiana, not from Georgia. So I actually believe that brisket is barbecue. And, oh, man, was it good. They age their beef at least 21 days. That makes it even beefier. That brings out the real good flavor. Go to omahasteaks.com today. Put Georgia in the search bar. See the Let's Go Grill package. You'll get 12 burgers for free with this package. That's an incredible deal. You got friends. You got family. Life's going back to normal. You're taking off your mask. You're having people in your house. You want to fire up the grill. You want to have good eats. It comes with a side. It comes with dessert. Go to omahasteaks.com. Put Georgia in the search bar. You will be happy. There's a great article at Real Clear Politics by Charles Lipson today, The Great Awakening, America's Latest Religious Revival. One of the most striking features, he writes, of American history is this periodic waves of religious fervor. We're in the midst of another today, stripped of its references to God, but filled with the same passionate desire to be reborn, absolved from past sins. What sins need absolution now? America's history of slavery and Jim Crow segregation. Those original sins continue, say the movement's leaders, in a new, vaguely defined form, structural racism. Revivals like this have been called Great Awakenings since the first one in the 1740s. Today's acolytes use similar language, so this one might be called the Great Awakening. Just as slavery and abolition were central to the second Great Awakening of the 1850s, so race is central now. In both cases, the message is that white Americans must act decisively to correct historic wrongs and pay penance for them. Today's progressive politicians also offer a measure of absolution. It's a costly one, a whole series of race-based policies, massive government spending, centralized controls, and economic redistribution, plus reimagining local law enforcement. Who are the sinful whites? In practice, they are everyone except descendants of enslaved African Americans. In this reframing, Americans of Chinese, South Asian, Korean, or Cuban ancestry are all considered privileged and, in a political sense, white. It is by faith that they do this. You know, if you haven't heard my interview with Tim Keller, the theologian, I encourage you to text the word data to 33777 and listen to it. You can also get my piece on the NCAA trying to make you care with their transgender sports rules. But one of the things I was struck by with Tim Keller, he writes in his new book, and we talked about this in my interview with him, conversation really, was how in the 60s, the civil rights movement was led by a bunch of preachers, and they were grounded in biblical language, but also hope. And nowadays, this social justice movement we're seeing now lacks hope. It lacks a hope for the future. It uses the language of Scripture without the underlying meaning of Scripture, without the underlying beliefs of Scripture. If anything, it uses the biblical language to condemn as opposed to liberate. It's not hopeful. It's pessimistic. It's divisive. In fact, Tim Keller talks about that, the current secular left and Black Lives Matter movement are deeply divisive institutions seeking to divide instead of to heal and to reconcile. And you see that with this great awakening that's happening right now, where these people want to divide us as a nation, and they're more intent on breaking us up than some people who are buying secession on the right. You got the left doesn't want anyone who disagrees with them to be a part of the future of this country. Hello and welcome across the nation. It is Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. You may not know it unless you're actively engaged in conservative politics, but there's this thing in the country called the State Policy Network. And it's a group of conservative think tanks across the nation. And those think tanks, some are better than others, but they come up with essentially a lot of conservative policy ideas for state legislatures. And arguably, in my mind, the gold standard for the longest time has been the Texas Public Policy Foundation. A brilliant group of men and women who have been decisively on the cutting edge of keeping Texas the state we know and love. And in large part, that leadership was to their former leader, Brooke Rollins, who then went to work as the domestic policy advisor for President Trump and is now starting a new national organization up in Washington, D.C. And Brooke, I got to tell you to begin, Brooke, that Josh Trevino tells me I should tell you that you're the greatest thing to ever come out of the University of Texas. And I know you're an Aggie fan, and I don't want to get in trouble with you.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to, first of all, hello, wonderful Eric. Second of all, I'm going to strangle our mutual friend Josh Trevino, who knows that my hot button is the Aggies versus the Longhorns. For all you Texas listeners, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But I'm definitely an Aggie, for the record.
All right. So I'm really excited for you with the American First Policy Institute. And because I've been thinking for a while, it's funny the number of conversations I've had with people on, is there a way to take what was done in the last 4 years that clearly resonated with Black, Hispanic, and Asian voters, building up this unheard of coalition on the right that we've never seen before? And is there a way to build those ideas for a greater, better American tomorrow? And it sounds like that's one of the things you're looking at doing.
Well, you couldn't be more spot on. You know, there were a lot of amazing things out of the last 4 years, the lowest unemployment rates, the lowest poverty rates, the achievement of the American dream for so many who'd never had a shot before, unprecedented peace in the Middle East, bringing soldiers home, energy independence. But Eric, all of these, every single one of those issues, we who've been in the conservative movement, your listeners who've listened for a long time, we all knew this, right? We knew that the founding fathers' vision of less government and more freedom was not just better for a select group of people, but it was better for everyone. And the last 4 years proved that out in spades. But what was really exciting is for the first time, to your point, we started really breaking through with that message to African Americans, to Hispanic Americans, to blue collar workers that realized again that the other side, that the left, they're radical ideas and concepts, their big government, that had done nothing but keep so many of our fellow brothers and sisters in generational poverty. And guess what? We changed it in the last 4 years. So building that out, continuing the policy concepts and ideas, fighting for freedom in this country, and taking the narrative directly to the Americans, to the hearts of the people, and making sure they know what's at stake and who's fighting for them, that is at the top of the list of what this organization is going to do.
David Shore is a Democratic pollster, definitely a progressive. He essentially got denounced, defamed, and run out of the progressive movement for pointing out last summer that the polling trends on defund the police look very bad for the left, that they did not like him saying that. And yet it turns out he was right, and he's got a lot of polling out now that shows it was Latina women in Florida, non-Cuban Latino female voters in Florida and Texas, that moved towards the president, President Trump, in large part because of law and order, and then Black and Hispanic men moving his direction because of jobs, which seems like a no-brainer to me. But I'm really actually curious if in the past you had George Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney all kind of made arguments on those issues, and yet for some reason they believe Donald Trump and went with him. And I'm just curious as to how you see why that happened.
Well, I think that the last 4 years represented a difference in the way we talk to the American people. I'll never forget talking to Rick Santorum, interestingly enough, about the Romney race, which, if we remember, he was sort of the at the edge of the stage in the first debate, and at the end it was just he and Mitt Romney. But he said he knew we were going to lose that race at the convention when Mr. Romney had, you know, a bunch of very similar looking people on the stage behind him, all CEOs and business owners. And what we did in the last 4 years, while our policies were good for the CEOs and the business owners, we made every speech, every event, every policy was about how does this affect the average American, the farmer, the blue collar worker, the stay at home mom, the hair braider, you know, who just wants to own a salon. How do we make these policies about them? And whether it was deregulation or tax cuts or fighting for school choice, that's how we, I believed, really began to change the narrative that our side is for the everyday American, and the left and the Nancy Pelosi's and the Chuck Schumer's and the Joe Biden's and the Kamala Harris's, they're for the status quo. They're for the elites. They're for the Washington, D.C. power structure, and we are for America. And again, this president was unorthodox. He was unconventional. But in many ways, he was able to break through in ways that no one in our side had really been able to do before. And you saw that in those numbers you just mentioned.
Well, yeah. And you know, let's go back to your days at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. A lot of what you guys did was really help make Texas a place to do business and attracted a lot of companies into Texas. And it was always the perception of, oh, you know, Republicans, these think tanks, the state policy network, they're for the rich, the CEOs, the professional corporation class. And yet underlying all of this has always been this sense of entrepreneurialism that seems now like the major corporations in the country are the new welfare class in the country, subsidized, given tax breaks, put at competitive advantages against the little entrepreneur. And Donald Trump, whatever people think of him, understood that there's this entrepreneurial spirit in America, regardless of race, and the corporations, the Fortune 500, the Republican elites and the Democratic elite don't seem to get it.
That's 100% right. And I'm glad you mentioned the Republican elites, too. I think that's an important piece here. I mean, certainly we're battling the left. We're battling a radical progressive agenda that really will destroy the country, will keep people in poverty for more generations that we may never recover. But in that, there is some complicity, if that's a word, complicity from the Aggie, but there is some complicit behavior from the sort of longtime Republican establishment as well. And I don't understand it, Eric. I can't imagine. Listen, you cannot like some of the tweeting, and I understand that. I really do. I was, you know, part of it for 3 years. I had the front row seat. But at the end of the day, you can't disagree with the policy and the millions of Americans, frankly, the millions of people in our world, but most importantly, Americans, who finally had a shot at the American dream due to these policies. So, you know, the America First Policy Institute, and thank you for bringing up my Texas Public Policy Foundation. I so appreciate that. The AFPI is really in the same vein and model as the Texas Public Policy Foundation. How do we find the right solution for Texans, for Americans, that will ultimately give them a shot, a real shot at the American dream, and do it in a way where we're reaching out to Hispanics, Black Americans, blue-collar workers, those who've never really aligned with us or haven't recently, so that they can understand it is our policies and our fight that will finally give them a shot at what this country promises.
Well, look, I'm excited for you doing it. I really am. I know there are a number of groups out there, and my concern, my fear is that there are going to be enough groups doing this that they work at cross purposes. I hope that won't happen. If I had to place bets on which groups would be dominant, anything with Brooke Rollins involved is going to be the dominant group. And I mean, honestly, I like you. I'm your friend. I'm not just saying that because you're on the phone with me. I mean, look at what TPPF has done. And so given your leadership there, I'm excited for what you're going to do, because I do think you get it. And not just because you're driving RVs to Aggie games and actually associated with actual Americans.
There is a benefit benefit to living outside of the Beltway sometimes, although I will say all the people on our team here in Washington are such freedom fighters. But listen, I couldn't appreciate that more, and I think that you are so right, and the way you frame the conversation is so important. And let me say about you, Eric, I'm so excited for what is to come and the voice that you will continue to have and build, because I believe we will win this country back. And when people mention all the organizations that are being founded right now from former Trump administration officials, by the way, we are by far the biggest. We've got 40 staffers that have been working for a month, 2 months getting ready for the launch. Former cabinet members, it will all be official in a couple of hours. You're going to love it. But ultimately, we're so outgunned by the left and by the Democrats. They have hundreds of these organizations, and we have a couple dozen. So if we can get this right and we can work together, which I know we can, and we can create a vision for this country, which I know we have and will continue to do, the sky is really the limit, and the soul of America will be saved.
Well, listen, I should probably leave it on that point, but I actually do want to ask you one more question related to that. That we've got an existing conservative infrastructure, much of which is maybe 40 or 50 years old. And I wonder, how do you see the injection of new blood with a lot of traditional conservative ideas that, frankly, they're still time-tested and true ideas, but not necessarily that I don't want to be rude here, but some of the 40-year-old organizations that send out white papers and no longer actually rack up gains and wins and no longer talk to people outside of white paper people. How do you kind of merge this together? Is it even possible to try to build a cohesion on the right that doesn't exist right now?
Well, I believe that there is an ability to do that, and I think that at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which granted, again, was a much smaller world than here in Washington, but when I sort of relaunched that 18 years ago now, including my 3 years in the White House, there was just such a disparate approach to working together, and we changed that in Texas, and you see the result of that, getting real policy done, changing the hearts and minds of our people. And now at the Washington level, there are some awesome organizations that today may be reevaluating, right? I mean, what the Trump 4 years proved, we completely changed conservative orthodoxy on a lot of different issues. And my goal is that there is 100% room for all of us, and that working together, we can really, really make this work. And here's the other thing that I think is exciting, Eric. One of the things that AFPI is going to be doing a little bit differently is we're really going to focus in the states as well. So it really is sort of a marriage of TPPF, the Trump presidency, and then a national new conservative organization. But the real battle, while it is in Washington, no doubt, especially with Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, but the real battle for the country is out in the states. It's in Texas. It's in Georgia. It's in Florida. It's in Pennsylvania. It's in Nevada. It's in California. It's in Oregon. And so taking these concepts and building them out, not just for a Washington-focused group, but frankly for an every state-focused group and working alongside these organizations, there's plenty of resources in the movement. We just have to do a better job of working together. And my goal is that the America First Policy Institute can lead the way with the new approach, but that everyone will come alongside and help us for the sake of the country.
Well, I'm glad I asked that. That's well said. And best of luck to you. If I can ever do anything to help, please don't hesitate to reach out. I'm a big fan, and I'm just excited that you're going to be leading something like this.
Oh, Eric, well, the feeling is mutual. Thank you. Thanks to all your listeners. And we will definitely stay in touch. I'd love to have a more regular voice on your show as we continue to figure this out.
Glad to have you. It's always good to talk to you, Brooke. Take care.
Thanks, Eric.
That's Brooke Rollins. She is the American First. Let me get the name right. Let me make sure. The American First Policy Institute, AFPI. Again, if you're a betting person, bet on Brooke Rollins. And yes, full disclosure, I'm a friend. Think the world of her. But the Texas Public Policy Foundation in Austin, Texas, has been a remarkable trendsetter for other think tanks, conservative think tanks around the country. The ideas they've come up with in Texas, extrapolated out to other states, modified to those state concerns, have really, you've seen a lot of other states embrace the ideas. And remarkably, it was Brooke Rollins who took this organization that had gotten kind of sclerotic and turned it around and really helped it grow. And now around the country, there are other groups that are kind of taking what TPPF did, for their states for conservatives, and now she's going to the next level and building a national one that actually understands the idea of federalism and has to reach out to the state level. So I've got a number of friends. I know Mike Pence is involved in an organization. My dear friend Russ Vogt is involved in an organization. Now Brooke Rollins is involved. Getting these groups not to work at cross purposes, but to find their specific area of engagement and work together, I think really will provide a renaissance of conservative ideas in the country at a time the Democrats are actually starting to struggle, because it's very clear that the Democratic ideas aren't resonating with the American people. It's why Black, Hispanic, and Asian voters shifted towards Donald Trump, even as white educated white men moved to the Democratic Party. The more secular the Democratic Party gets, they drive out minority voters who are more committed socially, conservatively, people of faith. There's an opportunity ripe for new ideas on the right, where we're not just running on zombie Reagan playbook from the 1980s. And good luck to Brooke Rollins and to all the others out there doing this. But keep your eye on American First Policy Institute. We'll be right back. Hello there. It is Eric Erickson here. Glad to have you with me. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. Thanks again to Brooke Rollins. And again, that organization is going to be called the American First Policy Institute. They're launching today, and they're going to have some cabinet rollout, some Trump cabinet members rolling out. I'm excited by the battle of ideas shaping up on the Republican side. There just isn't really a battle of ideas on the left right now. Consider Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang he's running for mayor of New York now. He lost his presidential bid. He was a CNN contributor for a while. The guy's got a lot of money. He's been involved in tech. He came down to Georgia, said he was going to move down to help the Democrats. Now he's moved to New York. He seems listless, trying to find something in politics. He's latched on to the mayoral race in New York, and he's actually doing very well in the polling. Progressives who liked him on the campaign trail but were a little skeptical of him are coming for him with gusto now, and one of the reasons is because of street vendors. Street vendors in New York are people that they sell things on the street, they sell food on the street, they go into the subways, and a lot of them are unlicensed. And there's a licensing regime in New York City that has deep costs, a lot of burdens. And Andrew Yang has come out and said, we need to crack down on the unlicensed street vendors, but we also, coupled with that, need to reform the regulations by which you get the licenses because they're so costly. Well, the left latched on to the former and ignored the latter. And they're now trying to demagogue him with Hispanic women who are the ones selling the churros and the like down in the subways without licenses, claiming he's going to shut them down, which is not really true. He wants to reform the system so it's easier for food vendors, it's easier for food trucks, it's easier for the license. Well, also Andrew Yang is now getting attacked by the Planned Parenthood crowd. And the lesson here, by the way, Andrew Yang is pro-abortion. Andrew Yang is totally fine with you killing kids. He just says Democrats don't need to be celebrating an abortion at any point in the pregnancy. It's a turnoff to a lot of voters for Democrats to say, yeah, as the child is passed through the birth canal, it should be legal for you to crack open its head, suck out its brain, and then rip it apart as it comes out. That's what a lot of Democrats think. As long as the head has not exited the birth canal, and for some Democrats, as long as the child hasn't exited the hospital, you can still chop it into bits and let Planned Parenthood sell the pieces. And Andrew Yang just says he's pro-abortion. He just says they should be celebrating abortion at all stages of pregnancy. At some point, it's a little ghoulish. So now the Planned Parenthood activists are attacking him. The moral of the story here is Andrew Yang is not a conservative. He's actually a liberal guy. But he's just not progressive enough. They're perfectly fine to take his money, but they really don't like the idea that he may be able to be engaged. He may be able to show up and be a part of what's happening. They don't like the idea that Andrew Yang could potentially be a major candidate. And the reason is because he's progressive, but not progressive enough. For example, one of the other attacks on Andrew Yang and Eric Adams as well, who's a local government official in New York, I believe Eric Adams is involved in government in New York already. He's polling well. And Andrew Yang and Eric Adams have something in common. They're not attacking the police. In fact, you've got Bill de Blasio joining progressives and attacking the very New York Police Department he himself is in charge of. And the Democrats are beside themselves that Andrew Yang and Eric Adams in New York City have the audacity to think that we can't get rid of the police department. They have the audacity to think that maybe, just maybe, we need the police. And maybe we should allow the police to crack down on crime instead of screaming racism every time they do. It is not helping Yang and Adams with the wokes in New York City. Andrew Yang, the guy they all loved when he was campaigning for president, they now hate him because it turns out he didn't want to get rid of the police and actually wants common sense regulation on street vendors so they're not selling you bad products in the subways without a license. You can sell bad products, you just need a license. But he wants to reform it all. He wants to lower the cost. You lower the cost, you break up monopolies that some of these people have. And they don't want that either. These people have become corporatists. The ones they warned you about voting for, that's now them. And they don't like him because he's willing to break it apart. Remarkable how the tables turn.